How attached are you to place? I don't just mean the grass under your feet or the streets of your town, but the people, the language, the customs, your work. Do you value being somewhere? Or are you a cosmopolitan? Live anywhere, work anywhere, you've got a credential that makes the world your oyster. Is this the new division in politics? British journalist David Goodhart has written The Road to Somewhere, The Populist Revolt and the Future of Politics. So just who are the anywheres and the somewheres?
The somewhere is probably the majority of the population, even in rich democracies like ours. I reckon about 50% of the population, perhaps a bit more, tend to be pretty rooted in the places they come from. They tend not to have experienced higher education. They tend to place a high value on familiarity, on security, and they're comfortable with and feel quite strongly in some cases group identities and group attachments of various kinds. There's this rather useful distinction that the American sociologist Talker Parsons came up with between achieved and ascribed identities. We're all on a spectrum. We all have both achieved and ascribed aspects to our identity. Somewheres have a much higher proportion of ascribedness in their identities, where, in other words, the things that you can't do anything about, that you just are, you know, you are a white male or whatever, or you come from a certain place. So, you know, you're a Scottish farmer or a working class Geordie or a Cornish housewife or whatever it is. That is a given in your identity. It's not anything you can do about. And if that is a higher proportion of your identity is likely to be more easily discomforted by rapid change. People from somewhere with these strong roots, with these strong attachments, with a desire for security, and I mean, they're not against change as such, but they're more easily discomforted by rapid change in a way that more highly educated people can kind of ride the waves of change more easily.
Yeah, and those more highly educated people, the ones who ride the change, are they the anywheres? You've got the somewheres, now you've got the anywheres. Who are they?
Exactly. I mean, the anywheres tend to be rather a smaller proportion of the population, although have been growing very fast in recent years, which is one of the reasons for the greater instability in our politics. The anywhere people, I reckon, are 20-25% of the population in this country. They will have gone to university, invariably also a residential university. It's a very important aspect of British society. It's actually not the same, not quite the same in continental Europe or the United States. I'm not quite sure what the situation is in Australia in this regard.
No, not the same in Australia on that point either.
Right. You can stay in your hometown and go to college in a way that is quite rare in Britain, combined also actually with London, the power of London, the fact that you often end up, if you're on a kind of upper professional career course, you will often end up, wherever you come from, working in London for a few years, perhaps abroad. So you've got a more educated and mobile group. And, you know, just in the way that values reflect lifestyle for the somewheres, values reflect lifestyle for the anywheres too. So if you're educated and mobile and you have what Talker Parsons calls an achieved identity, your sense of yourself comes from your relative success at school, the fact you passed exams, you went to a good university, and you then pursue a career, you become a lawyer or an accountant or whatever. And your sense of yourself comes from your own achievements.
Yes, and you think the world is your oyster.
But there's an element of sort of self-invention, and your sense of yourself is portable. You know, you can live anywhere among, you know, that's why I call them anywhere.
Yeah, but what your book brings out wonderfully is this tension. Now, there's a group called the in-betweeners, and they are about 25% of the population. But what your book brings out brilliantly is this tension between the somewheres and the anywheres. It strikes me, David, there's a new sort of snobbery in Britain, and it's got nothing to do with dukes and earls and Downton Abbey. It's just that these groups don't get each other, do they?
No, I mean, this is the sort of tragedy of modern politics. Both of these worldviews are completely legitimate, but they are also, in certain important respects and in certain policy areas, in conflict with each other. And the task of politics in the next generation or so is to try and create bridges between them, try and create a new settlement between these two groups. And I think that means primarily anywheres who have over-dominated our politics. I mean, this is a relatively recent phenomenon. If you go back 30 or 40 years, British common sense, probably like Australian common sense, was essentially somewhere common sense. I mean, there were some highly educated, liberal-minded people at the top of society who ran our universities, media organisations, and were probably disproportionately represented in politics. But they kind of knew they were a small minority and had to sort of genuflect to a much more socially conservative and cautious majority. That has become much less true in the last generation, say since the early mid-90s in Britain. That has produced what I call a kind of liberal overreach.
Yeah.
And populism is partly a reaction to that liberal overreach. A lot of somewheres just have stopped voting over the last generation.
David, you argue in the book that opposition to mass immigration isn't necessarily, or even most of the time, actually about race. In fact, you say that for most somewheres, it's deracialized opposition. So what is it that they fear about mass immigration into Britain?
They fear society changing too fast. They fear erosion of a certain dominant way of life. You know, you live in a certain neighborhood. The people around you are people that you're familiar with, people who obviously speak the same language as you in more or less the same way, and you have cultural reference points, and the shops and the pubs and whatever kind of reflect your story, your history. And in certain neighborhoods, there are some people who are xenophobic and racist. Most people, though, are not. One of the problems here is that we've talked about multiculturalism for the last couple of generations in a completely asymmetrical way. Multiculturalism, or having an ethnic identity, is something for minorities. Well, majorities have them too, we're now discovering. When majorities in certain places cease to be majorities, they feel uncomfortable. Not everybody, but many people will feel uncomfortable when their way of life seems to be changing, when the shops that you're familiar with start closing down and another set of shops start opening up. If your sense of yourself comes from your place and your roots, then you will be disturbed by that. And I think that is a perfectly... In the past, we've said opposition to immigration was either regarded as illegitimate, or if it was legitimate, it was accepted by liberals as legitimate only on economic grounds. You know, if there was downward pressure on wages or extra competition, perhaps over public services, that liberals, with some difficulty, sort of accepted. What they couldn't accept was that there were also cultural reasons for disliking large-scale immigration. Now, I think we're beginning to shift on those grounds too. I mean, my book was reviewed by Jonathan Friedland in The Guardian, and he kind of accepted, I think it was a very important moment, he accepted you can have cultural objections to rapid change through immigration, although he then went on in much of the rest of the review to complain about that, in effect.
But I mean, David, it strikes me that your argument is not really with immigration, even generous immigration when it's needed for economic or compassionate terms, but you're really arguing with transnationalism, with this idea of people who live between countries purely for economic benefits. Am I right?
I think, you know, any society to thrive needs to be relatively open. I'm not against some degree of immigration, nor are most people in Britain. But we have had, particularly since 1997, we have had historically unprecedented levels. And in certain parts of the country, it has led to very rapid change. But also in those places where there has been very little immigration, a lot of liberal critics of the people who want to reduce immigration say, but look how ridiculous, you know, the people in Barnsley, there aren't any immigrants in Barnsley in South Yorkshire. You know, what on earth are they complaining about? That's to misunderstand the social psychology of mass immigration. The fact that the story is no longer about the mining communities of South Yorkshire. You know, go back 30 or 40 years, well, there still was a mining industry, and the concerned liberal middle classes of London, the kind of Polly Toynbees, they would write about the miners. Their interest, the country's interest, was in these industrial communities. They had a place in the national story. Now, all of that is gone. If you're in Barnsley, a lot of people, I think the national story is now about the great urban centres, the urban centres dominated by the British minority populations.
Yeah. And just finally on this point about immigration, though, why is the free movement of people not necessarily good for the countries that those people are leaving?
Well, this applies to both European Union immigration under the freedom of movement rules, but also more broadly to immigration from poorer developing countries. I mean, there is a very, very real issue of brain drain. I mean, obviously, this is a convenient argument for those of us who think immigration has been too high, but I think it is also true you know, the National Health Service has for years taken individuals who've been trained at great expense in poorer countries to be nurses or doctors, and we've sucked them up and brought them to the UK to work at great cost to these poorer African or Asian countries. And that's really rather a scandal. And we should just train more people. We actually had, I didn't realize this, and the Theresa May government has lifted the limit, but we could only train, presumably for cost reasons, 6,000 doctors a year in Britain. Yeah. It's an extraordinarily small number. And so it's no surprise that we've been taking doctors from all over the world. The same thing applies, actually, even within Europe. I mean, you've had an extraordinary brain drain from Eastern Europe to Western Europe, particularly since opening up in 2004. And that has caused great damage, particularly to countries like Romania and Bulgaria, which have kind of lost large chunks of their educated middle class.
Yeah, well, how's this for a figure that you bring out? One third of Romania's doctors left Romania in just 2 years after it was admitted to the European Union.
Yeah, exactly. But I think there's a bigger point about freedom of movement, which applies to my anywhere, somewhere argument, which is that I'm sitting here in Hampstead in North London. It's a very affluent part of the city, full of lawyers and academics, and they or their children will be able to take advantage of freedom of movement. They'll go and work in Berlin or Paris for a couple of years, and it will enhance their lives. They won't suffer very direct competition from German or French or Spanish people coming here. If you're a working class northerner and you work in the food manufacturing sector, our biggest manufacturing sector is food. We employ about 400,000 people in it. Just since 2004, 120,000 of those people come from Central or Eastern Europe. Mm. So, you know, if you're a working class northerner, you do face direct competition as a result. It's a real kind of in-your-face globalization. So it's not just about your factory closing and moving to China. It is about a whole lot of people moving in, living next door to you and competing for your job. And those same people are much less likely to have the desire or aptitude or skills to go themselves to work in another European country. So they kind of, they're less likely to be able to take advantage of freedom of movement, and they're more likely to suffer competition as a result of it. So freedom of movement works very differently for different stratas of British society.
Yeah, and just to finish this point, you make the argument that many countries like Spain in recent years have used free movement to simply export their own unemployment crisis rather than actually tackle it on behalf of their people.
Yeah, I mean, it is one of the things you could say in defence of freedom of movement. I mean, it does allow those European economies that are booming, that are growing strongly, can sort of suck in some of the surplus labour from those economies that are doing less well. One can sort of see in the abstract that that has a benefit. If you regard Europe as a sort of single entity, then that's obviously a sort of sensible thing in some ways. But as you say, it also allows those governments that have mishandled their economy, or indeed the European monetary euro policies. They've had a growth disaster in southern Europe as a result of the euro in the last few years, and it reduces the political pressure to do something about it. Mm. If you have this safety valve, in many cases, a lot of the people that have come to London particularly, or to Britain in the last few years, have been, you know, relatively well-educated young Spaniards and Italians and Portuguese kids. They're the people who in normal circumstances would have been pushing for reform of the system in those countries.
Mm. Yeah, take away the educated middle class and you often lose that critical impetus for reform. It's Andrew West with you. My guest, David Goodhart, a British journalist. We're discussing David's book, The Road to Somewhere, The Populist Revolt of the Future of Politics. David, many of us have pretensions to being citizens of the world or cosmopolitans, but is it true that the vast majority of people, including in Europe with all its free movement, actually spend most of their lives within about 50 kilometres of the place they were raised?
Yes. I mean, the figure for the UK is about 60% of the British population live within 20 miles of where they lived when they were 14. We tend to be rather less mobile than we imagine. I've got some interesting stats in the book about party affiliation. I mean, the more nationalistic your party, the closer to your mother you are likely to live. Part of what I'm talking about is about that part of the value distinction I'm talking about is substantially about mobility, in fact. One point I do want to make is that I've invented these labels, you know, anywheres, somewheres, in betweeners. Obviously, there's a spectrum. I do in the book talk about the nuances and the distinctions within these large groups, anywheres and somewheres. There's a more extreme anywhere group I call global villagers. There's a more extreme somewhere group I call the hard authoritarians. But the point I want to make is that I've invented these labels. I have not invented the value groups that I'm labeling. They are there in the surveys, you know, as the academics like to say, they're there in the data.
Mm.
They're a real thing. I mean, it's not just an invention of mine.
Yeah. How has the globalization mentality and the philosophy of this anywhere class, and I actually think they're rather neat categories, but how has this mentality transformed but also undermined the British education system? Because this is a development that many of our listeners will understand, because a similar thing has been underway here.
Well, one of the great drivers of the anywhere worldview has been higher education, for all sorts of perfectly good reasons. I mean, higher education is about the pursuit of knowledge, and it's about often challenging tradition and challenging authority. You know, in some ways, it's set up to oppose the social conservatism that many somewhere people still regard as valuable and important to their lives. So there's a sort of liberal bias in higher education, as there should be in many ways. But it's the rapid helter-skelter expansion of higher education and the relative disregard for the other options for British school leavers. Now, this is an old story, but it's been reinforced in recent years. We've always done elite academic education pretty well, and we've been quite poor at vocational, technical, the whole apprenticeship system. You know, we had a relatively developed apprenticeship system until the deindustrialization of the 1980s, really, and it's never really come back. But it means that the options for those that do not get into an academic stream in their early or mid-teens and go on to do A-levels and go on to university, that number has expanded enormously. Indeed, Tony Blair, back in the early 2000s, called for 50% of the school cohort to go on to university, without, I think, really ever giving any thought to what that would feel like if you were not in that 50%, if you're in the other 50%. I think it's an extraordinary lack of kind of empathy in a way, and perhaps reflecting the way in which politics, even, or perhaps particularly centre-left politics, had been taken over by liberal graduates who thought that their version of the good life, their idea of social mobility, you know, coming from whatever background, from working class, low middle class background, going to an elite university and into a sort of higher professional job, that was the good life. That was what everybody should strive to do.
Mm.
But not everybody can do that or wants to do that. You know, you can't have everybody in the country working as a lawyer or as a political researcher.
I hope not. David Goodhart, author of The Road to Somewhere, The Populist Revolt and the Future of Politics.